You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters.
Hello, you beautiful people. Table Talk is a guide to the future of food and nutrition, brought to you by Food Matters. In these podcasts, we chat with visionaries from across the food industry to discover the ideas that will transform our food landscape. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer. I'm a broadcaster and I'm an all-round gastronaut. Now, absence makes the heart grow fonder, but does abstinence make the waist grow thinner? So we're talking about weight loss diets involving intermittent fasting today. It's been thought for many years now that intermittent fasting is a quick, effective and healthy way to lose weight. It's quite an industry. Whether it's the 5-2 diet, the 16-8, one meal a day or the warrior diet, there's plenty of choice and plenty of best-selling books to help you along the way. I'm looking at you, Michael Mosley. But does it really work? A new study suggests that the benefits of intermittent fasting are not all that they appear, and it's making us rethink what fasting can do for us. And today I'm joined by one of the study's authors, James Betts, Professor of Metabolic Physiology at the University of Bath. James, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me on the show.
Now, your study was published in June in the journal Science Translational Medicine. Before we get into the detail of it, can you tell me what the motivation was for the study? Why did you launch this? What did you want to find out?
The key thing with this one really was to separate out the effects of fasting and weight loss. And there's a large number of studies on fasting. So I should say this isn't the first study in the area at all. But the pattern that I was seeing was lots of studies showing that doing fasting diets was helpful for weight loss and for health improvement. But I always had that question in the back of my mind. Is this because of the fasting? Or is this just because people are eating less? Because we all know that any restrictive diet, if you eat foods that aren't beige, if you eat foods that start with the letter B only, you'd lose weight because you've limited your options and you eat less. So I really wanted to separate out, is there anything magical about fasting that goes beyond just eating less? And that's really what we tried to do with this study, a very basic science proof of principle. Is it fasting or is it weight loss that's helpful for people?
Now, to my mind, nutritional science must be an immensely difficult area to research because of the complexities of metabolism in different people, the differences in the way that individual bodies deal with food, plus the fact that you've got to rely on subjects sticking to the rules of a study and telling the truth as well. But also, you're trying to measure the impact of one trial in a complex human life with a multitude of different factors. We all do so many different things during the day that could impact on how we deal with food. And, you know, how does 1 week of fasting also affect somebody a year later, for instance? Is that right? Is this an immensely difficult area to study?
It really is. And any time you do a study, for every one person who says, great, I had the same question, thanks for answering it, there's 99 other people saying, well, we wanted you to do a different study. And it's kind of difficult to take when people aren't criticizing what you did. They just cross about the many studies you didn't do. So it is difficult for precisely the reasons you give, but I think this makes it even more important to define your terms at the outset, Be very clear about this is what we're trying to do with this study, and then by inference, this is what we're not trying to do. So yeah, there's been a few critics on YouTube and the kind of keyboard warriors out there saying, well, this isn't the type of fasting that we do day to day, and these guys are corrupt, they're funded by industry, and this study was too short. And actually, it's been very easy just to point back to our clinical trial registration and say, go and read that. You can see exactly what we were trying to do from the outset. And yeah, we're not trying to sell a diet book. I'm not recommending that anybody goes out and tries these horrible diets that we did in the study, because I can see that they're not feasible. They're not something you could sustain long term, but they do tell us a lot about how the body works. And all those complexities you mentioned, this variability is very difficult to control for. Thankfully, with a lot of the very basic responses, when we're looking at gene expression and so on, you sometimes get a bit more consistency. So everybody likes to talk about how different we are, but in many ways, we're all very similar, which is nice to know. But then in terms of some of the other responses we saw, like behavior and what we decide to do with our diet, we can all be very different from one another. And you can be different from yourself last week. You know, there's a lot of variability within a person. So you measure them, do something once. And if you did the study again, they could respond very differently.
Okay, well, let's dive into the meat of all this. How did you go about this particular study?
Yeah, to answer that question that I started with then of whether this is about fasting or weight loss, that's actually very simple to decide generally what the study is going to be about. And then, of course, the devil's in the detail and all the complexity is how that was done day to day. But essentially, we wanted to come up with an experimental design where we're going to have one group who are going to get fasting and no restriction of their calories at all, so they wouldn't lose weight. One group who are going to get calorie restriction and weight loss, but without fasting, so we've separated them. And then we wanted a third group, which were going to get both, so they would get intermittent fasting with the calorie restriction. So that's the simple step, that we know we want to create those three conditions. How you do that then is difficult for us. There's lots of options and ways we could have done the study differently, and maybe some people would say should have done the study differently. And of course, the difficulty for the participant. So for example, that first group where we want someone to fast and not lose weight. Well, obviously, the way you do that is that for every 24 hours you go without food, the next 24 hours you have to have double the food. It doesn't take a mathematician to work out you then have achieved balance overall. So that's easy to say, far more difficult to do. And our participants, who I'm eternally grateful for going through that, and they did achieve it according to the measurements we have, they actually report to us that the going 24 hours without food they thought was going to be the tricky bit, and that was actually much easier than the eating double side of things. Whereas the group who were then doing weight loss without fasting, that's more of a conventional diet. So that group was just having 25% fewer calories every day at every meal. So they didn't adjust their feeding patterns at all, and therefore they didn't have any long periods that we would call fasting other than while they were asleep.
The participants in these are real heroes sometimes, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, that we were so grateful to them for sticking to these things. But I should say we don't pay for these studies, so I'm especially grateful for people's goodwill. And part of the reason we don't pay isn't me being stingy, but it's because if you're having free living studies where you really want to see what happens to people, we don't want people to withdraw, we don't want people not to adhere. So these people who take part in our studies tend to do so because they're incredibly interested in the science and they want to know what the answers are and help us find them. So I have no doubt that they were doing what we asked them to. And of course, the scans that we do at follow-up really showed us that remarkably people had managed to eat the calories when we asked them to and managed to abstain from them when we asked them to. So yeah, I'm confident that we did achieve groups doing what we asked them to. And these diets were quite extreme, which is kind of a good thing for science, because it means that if you've hit your problem with a sledgehammer and really polarized those groups, it means you don't need 100,000 people in a study to see the differences. So we see some quite clear effects in this study to them.
Okay, so you're pretty confident that your participants did what they were told and you controlled them very well. So what did you discover?
There was a number of measurements we made. I think when we're asking people to go through these things, we owe it to them to measure absolutely everything we can do in our lab. One of the primary outcomes, which is most relevant to many people, is when they want to know what's happened with their weight loss. So to start with that, we actually found that the two groups who were expected to lose weight, either through intermittent fasting or through what we might call standard daily dieting then, they didn't lose a drastically different amount of weight. So both groups lost a couple of kilos, but the intermittent fasting group was slightly inferior in that, but not significantly so. The big difference comes when we look at the DEXA scan. This is a scanner that we have that can look at your bone, fat, and non-fat mass or muscle mass separately. And so that's what people don't tend to have in their bathroom at home. And that really revealed to us then that if we start with the good news story, if you're doing daily dieting, just trying to eat a bit less at breakfast, lunch and dinner, they lost a couple of kilos and almost every gram of that was reductions in fat mass, adipose tissue on the body. So that's what most people are aiming for, I think. There's few people who are doing a diet to try and lose muscle. Whereas when we then look at the fasting group, although if they stood on their bathroom scales, they'd be celebrating the same way, losing a couple of kilos. Almost exactly half of that was fat mass. So therefore, the remainder was from non-fat mass, which is tissues like muscle. So that probably is, I think, a useful finding up front that anybody could understand and is important to a lot of people.
I'm quite shocked by that. Was it something that you suspected? I mean, you know a huge amount about metabolism, or is it something that surprised you?
Well, I designed this experiment about 10 years ago, and it took a few years to find funding to get it done. And I think when I designed the experiment, the jury was out. We had hardly any data, but the different suggestions that came over that first five-year period, there were some authors suggesting that because when you fast, you might shift to use more fat, that it could be more effective for fat loss. And there were others suggesting, well, long periods without protein in particular could stimulate a more catabolic state and more muscle loss. By the time we published, although the findings of this paper are still novel, my impression is that the balance of scientific literature was more falling on the latter side, and people were suggesting that fasting is especially good to retain muscle mass. And this study really is consistent with that. So I think by the end, I was less surprised by the finding. We still needed the answer, but the fact that muscle was lost, I think, is understandable. Mm. And that could be partly, as I said, because there's long periods without food, especially amino acids, protein. The other thing this links into then is another observation we made, is that when individuals were doing a standard diet, they maintained their usual levels of behavior and physical activity. Whereas when they were fasting, their physical activity levels dropped. And that really fascinates me when you stick together kind of molecular measurements, metabolic responses, if you like, with behavioral.
Absolutely.
And everybody seems very caught up on the metabolic and say, well, you know, if you eat breakfast, it kickstarts your metabolism. If you fast, then you go into this starvation mode where you slow your metabolic rate. And those two things are really, I don't know if I want to say myths, but certainly they either don't happen or the magnitude with which they happen is much, much smaller than people realize. Whereas the behavioral response has a huge capacity. If you're feeling energized and say, yes, I'll go out for a walk and are just fidgeting around, over a day, over a week, you can accumulate a vast amount of energy expenditure. And therefore, the opposite is also true. If you spontaneously become a bit lethargic, you can save many calories. And that's what we see in this study and several past studies we've done, actually. If people are fasting, then they just seem to subconsciously cut out physical activity from their lifestyle, which has an impact on their net calorie deficit, but also could link into muscle loss. You know, especially older populations, if you cut your physical activity, it's very difficult to maintain muscle mass if you're in an energy deficit.
But what's fascinating about this is that people don't like to admit to the complexities of nutrition and dieting. They love the sound of, well, if I fast, I lose weight quickly. And the fact that you then have to say, well, it's a little bit more complicated than that, just doesn't really sit well with a lot of people. Have you had a lot of kickback about this? From you mentioned people, sort of the keyboard warriors. There is a huge industry in people peddling, not lies about nutrition, but selective information in order to support their latest book. What do you feel about this? Does it frustrate you as a person and dealing with these things on a daily basis where it has a massive effect on people's lives? Do you feel that there is an industry that is making people less healthy?
Yeah, it's a shame that this is the way it is, but I think it's also understandable because, as you mentioned, nutrition is complex. It's an area where you can oversimplify, so people do that either because we like to do that, or sadly, because there's money to be made, that you can sell diets, you can sell diet books. So I think some people simplify intentionally to sell the thing that they want to sell. You would think fasting would be immune from that because a company can't sell you a product that involves not eating it. Mm. But actually, I think this is where the diet books and the keyboard warriors come in, because a lot of people are critical of anything that questions. Fasting is close to a lot of people's hearts. They've done it. It's worked for them. Yep. And I should say, fasting is effective. It does result in weight loss. Our study shows that fasting is effective. Yeah. It just wasn't as effective as standard dieting. That's in people who did it. Now, if we said, well, I've tried standard dieting and I can't stand it, arguably in practice then, fasting won here, because you still lost fat and it's something you might actually do. So we have to keep that in mind. But yeah, I was aware when we published this that you could count on one hand, really, the number of papers that have isolated the effects of fasting, yet there's 5,000-10,000 books selling us fasting. And so I expected that there would be some kickback against the findings. And this is not a perfect study. If someone wanted to criticize it, there's plenty of things they could pick out. I feel the more major criticisms we are quick to acknowledge first in our own paper. But some of the criticisms we've had really, I don't think, stand up.
Yeah.
One, as I mentioned, was criticizing the funding, that papers funded by industry, of course, are going to show that fasting doesn't work, which is a puzzling one because this paper wasn't funded by industry and shows that fasting does work. Also, the question about whether this study, because this particular study was done in lean individuals, which as a scientist really just for us means their body mass index was less than 25. We've repeated the study in overweight and obese individuals, but I think there's a bit of a misunderstanding, or as we said, an oversimplification there. We shouldn't see a study in lean individuals and hear skinny individuals who don't need to lose weight. Plenty of people have a BMI in the mid-20s, below 25, who are classified as lean, but are still trying diets, still have weight they'd like to lose or would benefit them to lose. So I definitely think that it's worthwhile to look at lean individuals in these types of studies too.
Yeah. Now, I know that it's not incumbent on the researcher to explain issues outside of the area that you've defined for your research, but people point to other aspects about various different diets, including fasting, things like reduced insulin levels, reduced blood sugars, reduced blood pressure, inflammation. I mean, did any of the results touch on other issues beyond the weight loss issue?
Yes, we measured a vast range of metabolites, hormones, both related to the health effects, things like glucose and insulin, cholesterol that your GP might measure to gauge your health, but also regulatory ones that might try and explain the mechanisms behind other things that we've seen. So when we look at those metabolites, something that we do a lot in our labs at Bath is not just to take the fasted value. That's understandable that in the NHS, for example, you go in, you have your fasted blood sample. But what we can do in these focus studies is have someone stay in the laboratory for a day or two sometimes. Mm. And we can look at sequential meals, because the majority of our day is spent in a fed state. And you can learn a lot more about someone's health and metabolic control by looking at that. So we did this, I think, really thoroughly. We had them come in the lab and spend a whole day having a series of meals with us. So we could look at how they respond to that, their metabolic control, whether their blood sugars, whether their blood lipids are under control. And actually, we didn't see any effect of either fasting or weight loss in this group. Mm. As I mentioned, this is the lean cohort that we finished already. And they were already reasonably healthy to start with. A couple of results in relation to their cholesterol changed in a positive direction slightly, but no difference between treatments. So if we're just asking about the broad range of kind of health effects that the GP might measure, we weren't seeing any effects. Of course, remember, this is a short-term study. Mm. Again, these were quite extreme interventions. So it's no surprise that we didn't have people eat double every other day for 6 months or a year. On that, though, I do often question who says that diets have to last 6 months or a year. If we can come up with some diet that you can do once every January for a New Year's resolution and it loses the weight you gained in the other 11 months, then little and often and a steady diet might be ideal. But if people can't do it, this might still be useful.
Absolutely.
So I think that's it for the health markers. When we think about regulation, we measured a lot of appetite hormones. A lot of the way that our hunger is regulated is through hormones that come mainly from the gastrointestinal tract and your gut, but also from body fat. And we didn't see any changes in those either. And this is consistent with a general pattern in the literature that fasting doesn't really seem to have a super profound effect on appetite and appetite regulation, which might be something interesting to think about, that if you don't eat for a period, we all think, well, when you let someone loose on their diet, they're going to just completely make up for that and make poor choices and eat lots more. And, you know, some of those things may happen for some people, but it certainly doesn't seem that you make poor enough choices and that your appetite is so large that you make up for it. So I think that's another win for fasting, that you can kind of endure that period without food and then bank it almost, bank that negative deficit there and move on and eat normally, and you won't actually make up for the food that you miss. So that's one of the reasons why it can be useful for weight loss.
Yeah, there's an interesting psychological aspect to it, isn't it? I know a lot of people sort of talk about this. It's sort of a feeling of elation, feeling of achievement, almost trumping humanity, your urges and being able to control that as being something very positive. And what you've said is interesting anyway, that fasting is useful. Is there any other advice that you can offer people who enjoy fasting, who like it, to be able to make it more effective so you don't lose muscle mass? Or is that just endemic to the situation of fasting? You know, you're just not going to run when you're fasting.
That's a great question, and I absolutely have been thinking along those lines. People like a nice binary yes-no in life, and so, yeah, the critics have kind of put me in the box of doesn't like fasting and the study shows don't fast. On the contrary, yeah. We need the studies to understand that stuff better, and I'm one of the people trying to do those studies. But I think in advance of, you know, we can't await 10 years for the clear answer on that, my thinking would be, how to use the study that we have now and the current state of evidence. Well, you could just take a very simplistic view and say, don't use fasting, go with standard daily dieting because you would lose more fat and less muscle. But I think if you know that you like fasting and you want to use it, then the more sophisticated way to use a study like this is just to think, okay, well, what are the pros and cons? And we can do a full kind of risk benefit analysis here. Well, if we know that two of the risks, for example, are that you might become less physically active and you might lose some muscle mass. Well, think, what can I do about that? Well, you could make sure that, and these would be some of the interventions that we'd like to study now, but right away you could say, well, if fasting makes my metabolism slower, then there's not a lot you can do about that. But since we showed that it's a behavioural response and you cut out activity, then we're all in control of that. So you can do fasting and just be aware that you're likely to cut out some activity on, especially on your fasting days, and insert those opportunities consciously to then beat the system, if you like, and say, well, I know that I might be fidgeting less at my desk, so I will consciously set an alarm and go for a walk every hour or something. And that would also go some way to solving the problem maybe of losing muscle mass, particularly if you put in certain exercises that we know will maintain muscle mass. And alongside that, you could think about the diet that you have with this. You could make sure that you're eating protein regularly during the fed periods to try and offset that deficit. So, yeah, I think there's a lot we can do to try and make the best of fasting while hopefully mitigating some of the potential negative side effects.
I'm really impressed by the level that you're talking with about fasting and the fact that you're, you know, saying, yes, it's really useful at some level. Now, if we just go back to the idea that there is nutritional advice that's given by everyone, by the World Health Organization and by Public Health England, by me and you and the people who are desperate for people in the UK to be eating better and enjoying their life more. I mean, it's pretty consistent and it's just not that interesting, really, isn't it? It's eat less saturated fat, have less salt and sugar, more fruit and veg, move more. How can we just make this advice better? Have you come across any way of trying to get people to change their lives for the better that is consistent and that is long lasting and that makes them enjoy their lives more?
Short answer there is no. I think I'm comfortable with my area of expertise and I know lots of behavioral psychologists, so I feel like it's over to them to solve that. I mean, I do feel that if I had a quirky way of helping people to find something that worked for a majority of people, I could make a lot of money writing a diet book. But I agree with you. I think if I'm telling people that, yeah, move more, do exercise, don't be sedentary, eat lots of vegetables, eat variety. I mean, it's all very boring, long established advice. But yeah, the short answer is there is no magic bullet. So I think if anyone's selling you a kind of one-off, this is the way and it's the way for everybody, more importantly, I think that the actual smart money is in saying there's lots of solutions. Some people prefer fasting, and that can be effective. Some people prefer other approaches that might not even involve diet. Some people say, well, I like my food, so I'm just going to tackle my health purely through physical activity. There's lots of different effective approaches. Yeah. And I just think we need to, I completely agree with what you said earlier, that there's so much misinformation out there. And if we really believe that diet, physical activity and obesity are important, maybe this needs a bit more regulation, because if we realize that it's a potential solution to society's problems, and, you know, barring COVID, cardiovascular disease, I mean, even including the recent pandemic, cardiovascular disease hasn't gone away, still complicates COVID. And if we really want to take this seriously, maybe we need to say, well, recognizing that diet and exercise advice can be a solution, but also is a big part of the problem, maybe this does need a bit more regulation to stop the misinformation getting out there. Because I'm not kidding myself, I'm very proud of this paper and thrilled when there's invitations such as this one to talk about it to a larger audience. But there's millions of people following YouTubers who have no qualification to comment on these things and frankly give misinformation. But I'm well aware that there's more people hearing that message than from the study authors, or that could really be expected to read the scientific paper and take it away. So I think maybe we need a bit more connection there and a bit more critical thinking training amongst society to know what's fake news and what's real, because a lot of people nowadays just believe what they want to believe, I think.
Well, let's see for a moment if we can just combine those two worlds, the Instagrammers with their own personal stories of experience and actual decent research that's looking at things in isolation. What about you? Do you think you will change the way that you eat after having done this study? Is there anything else that you will personally take away from your research?
I mean, I don't know if I always follow my own advice or even my own research findings. I think we did a series of experiments before this one about breakfast, which largely debunked a lot of the benefits of breakfast people thought there were. But yet I, at that time, was a breakfast non-consumer and have now started to have breakfast during all the recent kind of lockdowns over the last year or so. So I certainly don't follow my own data all the time. I try and be physically active because I know that, you know, short of not smoking, living an active lifestyle, I think, is one of the most important things you can do. I mean, you mentioned earlier about these sensations of being elated and so on during fasting, which isn't my research area. But 2 weeks ago, I did pilot our new experiment on myself, which involved not eating for 5 days. And that was a real eye opener for me that, as everybody told me I would, I felt very tired and hungry on day two, but then suddenly seemed to perk up and felt energized, if anything. So there's definitely these more subjective angles that people like me taking blood samples can't measure a hormone that tells you you're elated on its own. But there's certainly these aspects where the subjective experience of people doing it is valuable.
Yeah,
I just think that we need to explore that in a more empirical way, rather than just having anecdotes of one Instagrammer telling you how they felt. Those things can be studied scientifically too.
Excellent. Okay.
And they are, I should say, but we just need more data.
Okay. So just one last question. What's next? What do you think is the next area to look at? I know that researchers always call for more research after having done their research, but what do you think is fascinating? What do you think has opened up so that you can study next?
Next thing for me, following these findings, is we're doing a couple of things in our lab, and that is to try and study how fasting can interact with other things. So I want to, as I've been talking about so far, overlay fasting with physical activity, exercise prescriptions, and with adjusted dietary profiles. So, for example, using protein or carbohydrates at key times. And the other thing that interests me a lot is how these kind of patterns of feeding and fasting interact with circadian rhythms. And that's an area of huge potential, because when we eat occurs relative to our activity levels, and then both of those things are regulated by or related to when we sleep and when our body is expecting to eat, sleep and be active. So we're doing a few studies where we have people stay a couple of days in our lab, and we can see how there's rhythms in various aspects of metabolism over a day or two.
That sounds absolutely fascinating. We've been talking so much more and more over the last few months about the importance of sleep and the connection to nutrition and weight gain and weight loss. So I really look forward to finding out more about your research there. James, thanks so much for talking to me today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you've been listening to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by Food Matters. And if you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from food standards to lab-grown meat. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Thank you so much for listening.